Welcome to Nourish and Shine, where I talk with passionate leaders in the fields of nutrition, functional and integrative medicine, and wellness, providing inspiration and practical advice to nourish your mind, body, and spirit, optimize your health, and live a whole vibrant life starting now. Today, I'm talking with my dear friend, Sarah Stinson. She is an amazing woman, full of love and light and compassion. She has so much wisdom to share that I had to make this a two-part series. So this week, we're going to talk about resilience. Next week, we're going to talk about healing touch, which she is a practitioner of. So this week, one of the most exciting parts that I found a ton of value in is the exercises she gives to practice. You can start applying these right away. I hope you really enjoy this episode. Welcome, Sarah Stinson, to Nourish and Shine. I'm so excited to be talking with you today. If you can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
I sure can, and I'll try to make it brief. I recently did a presentation for 250 of our leaders, and I think I spent 15 minutes trying to describe who I was. So for the course, for this podcast, I think it's just important to know that I'm very passionate about helping people to truly realize their human potential and to do it in a way where they accept both their inner and outer beauty, mind, body, and spirit. And then my background is, as far as my training, I have a master's in community counseling. And from that, I've expanded into more of a holistic approach to working with people. So I have a certification in massage therapy. I am also a certified healing touch practitioner and instructor of course one. And then recently I graduated from a 2-year fellowship from the Academy of Integrative Health and Medicine with an interprofessional integrative health and medicine fellowship.
Awesome. And part two next week, we're going to talk with you about healing touch, which I'm so excited to get into. And the fellowship we did together, and that's one of the ways we got to know each other, which was really fun. And we met a lot of awesome people. So can you tell me kind of how you got interested in this topic? So we're talking today on resilience. How did you get into it?
You know, it's interesting when I look back at my life and my career choices and even educational choices, I feel extremely grateful that I tend to get guided or led into various directions that I would not have been aware of before. So about 5 years ago, I was given an opportunity through my employer to take a resiliency training with Dr. Sood, who then was a physician and researcher, teacher, author at Mayo Clinic in Rochester. And that opened up the opportunity for me to learn more about resiliency. And then if you look at the research and the chronic stress that we're dealing with in our culture and the inability really for people or the challenges that people have to truly know how to manage difficult situations, I just really think it's a timely and important topic. And the value to me, as Dr. Sood has said when he taught it, is that building resiliency helps us to create a kinder, more compassionate, and loving world. And I think if we can do that, then we can do anything.
Oh, absolutely. That's like spot on. And so can you tell us a little bit more about what resilience actually is?
Yeah. And so I think, you know, you could look it up and there's tons of definitions as anything. And there's tons of research and podcasts out there that actually talk about resiliency. And I think a simple definition is really just learning how to move through life's challenges. You know, people probably would have called me a Pollyanna before in my life, and they still might, but I'm a very optimistic, positive person. And there was probably a time in my life where I was a little naive, especially when I was beginning in my therapy field as a counselor in the early 1990s, where I thought, you know what, we can all get through everything and life is going to be great and there aren't going to be so many challenges. And I've learned through maturity and life experiences that the beauty is there will always be challenges. And with each challenge is the opportunity for growth and an opportunity for us to become stronger. I remember when I saw the Dalai Lama speak years ago in Madison, Wisconsin, and we wrote questions. And my question was one of the questions that they chose for him to answer. And I asked, what was your biggest challenge in life? And in my mind, I was thinking it was when he had to leave his country at a very young age and was ostracized and not able to come back into that country, along with seeing such devastation to the land and to the people he loved. And what he said was profound and it has stuck with me. And I think it ties into the whole idea of resiliency. And it was that Every day offers its own challenges and its opportunities to find happiness. And so I think with resiliency, it's just really that simple idea that there are challenges every day, and how do we have the strength and find the tools and the support to move from them and grow from them.
That's awesome. And how do you teach that?
So what's really fun is that, you know, again, I really do have to give credit to Dr. Amit Sood and his resources and references. I think you'll be able to put on the podcast website when we're done. But there's some really simple tools that he has presented, and how he says it that I think is so important is that in this day and age, we're just so busy and we're under so much stimulation and distraction that it's really hard for the brain to operate like it might have 20 years ago, when people could meditate for 20 to 30 minutes in a day, or they could find that time to be quiet, where now we might only have seconds or minutes where we have to kind of regroup and find that sense of peace and that sense of sanity in our daily chaos. And so there's three really easy techniques that he has taught and that I teach when I go out and do presentations and that I practice in my own life. And it's called Simply 5-3-2. And if you Google Dr. Sood, S-O-O-D, and you Google 5-3-2, it will tell you. One of the techniques, though, that I think is so powerful is morning gratitudes. And, you know, I think you and I learned about gratitude and the power of appreciation in our fellowship, but this research is astounding. I mean, you can find so many articles on how the power of appreciation can shift you into a positive place, but it also helps with your immune function, your cardiac functioning. It helps with relationships. It can help with stress. It can help you present clearer because you're in a place of happiness and love. And so if you're okay, could I take you through it real quick?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
So if you are driving and listening to this podcast, then I would encourage you to try this when you get home or to Google it, and then you can find the process. I just think it's a really beautiful exercise and it's so simple. So the idea is that in the morning, generally the first thing that we do is, well, at least I do, is you start thinking of your to-do list. You know, what is it that I have to do, or what is it that I didn't finish the day before? And so we often wake up with our brain already expressing cortisol and increasing our cortisol or our stress hormone. And wouldn't it be nice if instead we could create that sense of love? So release oxytocin instead of cortisol. And then the beautiful thing is later in the day when you're stressed, your brain has an opportunity to say, hey, do I want to go down that path of stress or that path of love? So with that, we'll just do this real quickly. And the beautiful thing is it takes literally 90 seconds. So are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay, and the listeners are ready? So just find a comfortable place. And if you can, you can close your eyes. And then just take a few deep breaths in and out. And you don't have to do anything fancy, just find your natural breathing rhythm. And then imagine you're in bed and you're waking up, and the first thing you allow your mind to do is to visualize somebody in your life right now that you are grateful for. You see their face, and in your mind's eye, you look at them eyes to eyes, and you put a smile on your face, and they smile back, and you extend a silent gratitude. Then pick somebody in your family that you appreciate, that has made a difference in your life. And again, visualize them in front of you, a smile on your faces, and extend a silent gratitude. Now visualize somebody that has passed on, somebody that made a difference in your life, that brought joy, love, and appreciation to you. And as you see them, again, extend that silent gratitude and give them a hug. Next, you can imagine your younger self. It can be your 8-year-old self or whatever age you want to go to. And you see your younger self with the fun hairdo and the clothing of that generation. And in your mind, look into your eyes of yourself and say thank you for everything that you've brought to the world and the difference that you make every day. And give yourself a hug. And then last, imagine somebody or an animal, if you have a pet, that brings joy and a smile to your face. Give them a hug or a pet and say a silent gratitude. And then just take a breath in and out, and then you can come back and open your eyes. And then just for a moment, notice how that shifts where you were before And if we started our day that way every day, how different it could be.
I love that.
Yeah. So it's called the Morning Gratitudes. And what's so beautiful is I had presented once at a cardiac rehab group. And months later, a woman came up to me in the parking lot and said that her dad had been there and he had had a heart attack. And I don't know if he had a pacemaker, what kind of surgery he had, but he had been very angry and sad for a long time after that. And then he started this practice. And she said they noticed a considerable difference in him and that he would smile and he had more joy in life. So it's a very simple practice that we can all do.
Absolutely. And I felt like even just doing it then, you know, like you can't not smile when you're thinking about those people and giving people hugs. And even when I opened my eyes again, I had a smile on my face and just, you feel lighter.
Exactly. And you know, it's really cool too, because smiling actually activates a part of the brain that has to do with happiness. So your brain smiles when you smile.
Awesome. That is a great practice.
Isn't it? And it's like I said, 90 seconds. And the other two are really simple. The other one is 3 minutes, and it's about novelty. You know, so often we get, I think we get in zones and we don't notice things differently. And it's kind of like the same old thing. So like, especially when we get home or we go to work, or even when we go into the grocery store, or you go somewhere where you see people, you just kind of get into that routine of not necessarily smiling or acknowledge them, but also trying to get in our to-do list. Like, okay, when I get home, then I might change the lighting. I might go right to the dishes. I might listen to my voicemail. I might check my emails instead of being present with the people that are there. And so taking those 3 minutes to pretend that you haven't seen them in a long time, and it's like seeing your best friend who you haven't seen for a year, and doing that with all the people that we come into contact with, and then not trying to change the situation. And when you have kids, I think it's a little harder, especially if there's teens and they're leaving things around on the floor and you're walking in and you're tripping over it. Your instinct is to move that and to say, why did you leave it there? Instead of just kind of smiling, saying, I can wait 3 minutes to talk to them about why they left it there and engage in how was their day, or having that, you know, contact without any social media, without any internet, without any technology, and just being fully present.
Awesome. And so for novelty, so basically the take home is when you see someone, even if it's someone you see all the time, like your children or whatever, when you get home for the first 3 minutes, you just are pretending like you haven't seen them in a long time. So you're really having full like interest in everything they're saying and doing and being uninterrupted.
You got it. Very well said.
I love it.
You know, and I even do it with flowers. So like sometimes I'll just buy one flower now because I can then fully appreciate it and see everything in it and the nuances. And sometimes when you have a whole bouquet, you miss it. It takes too much energy to appreciate every flower. So I just appreciate one at a time now.
That's really cool.
Yeah. So I just really like that idea. And, you know, and I've caught myself coming home and then, you know, Dan and I have different body temperatures. So right away I'm changing the fan or the curtains or something. And I'm like, wow, I really do that. So now just being present and being excited to see him as if I haven't seen him for a long time.
That's so cool. I'm going to try that.
Yeah. And it's really good for families. You know, Dr. Sood said once in a presentation that nowadays we only have like 90 seconds of uninterrupted time with our loved ones in a household before somebody goes to doing something or, you know, engaging in some kind of technology.
Wow, that's incredible. What a change.
Yeah, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, and it was interesting when I just did a presentation on Friday to a women's center. One of the women said, you know what, I see myself doing that. So I'm going to really practice that because I think that would help me be more present and more loving when I come home. So.
Oh yeah. And that's, it just makes me think about eating together as a family too. That's something that's really important to us. And I think even doing this practice, like while you eat your supper and like really being fully present and like not worrying about to-do lists or, you know, what didn't go right or whatever, but really spending time with the people that you're eating with, I think would be cool too.
And because my background is also as an eating disorder therapist, I find that that's one of the hardest assignments we give people is to truly be present with the families for eating, because I think we haven't learned that. And we take, you know, we spend what, maybe 15, 20 minutes eating a meal and often it's on the go. So, you know, having that time and also making sure that we don't talk about things that create conflict at mealtime and more focus on, you know, how, what can we appreciate about each other and the appreciation for the food and that mindfulness piece when we're eating.
Yeah. Can you dive into a little bit about avoiding conflict while you eat? I think that's a super interesting topic too.
And then I'll come back to the the 5-3-2. How's that?
Yes. Yeah. I don't want to get you off track.
Oh, no. Trust me. My mind goes all over. So we're good. So I think the conflict with eating, if you think about it, just the same idea of what we talked about with the morning gratitudes. If I wake up thinking about my to-do list or that I'm not good enough or, you know, what I did wrong the day before, or if I screwed up on the podcast or whatever it is, you know, you release that cortisol instead of the oxytocin. So when you're at a mealtime, it is so important that your body be in that state of relaxation just for digestion. When we are stressed, we're contracted, so things don't digest or metabolize as well. You know, for instance, there's a great book called The Slow Down Diet, and he talks about, you know, when you're going to eat a piece of chocolate cake, if all you're thinking about is the guilt about the calories and the lack of nutrition, then your body is not going to, one, enjoy it as much, but also it's not going to metabolize it as well, and you might have problems. Whereas if I embrace it and say, this is the most amazing piece of cake, I love it, it's an experience of joy for me, then you release different hormones in your system that allow that to be digested differently. So I think it's pretty profound and a simple thing we could do, but we often don't. And then the other thing is really practicing, like, putting our utensils down between each bite. Often we eat so fast and quickly, and then allowing all of our senses just to enjoy the pleasure of the food and where it came from. That allows us to stay away from the conflict. You can always discuss the things that didn't go right in your day or the issues with your children or your spouse or whoever or work after dinner. But, you know, make that a sacred time where really the focus is enjoying the meal and the nourishment for your body and the connections with each other without any interruption.
That is fantastic. What about people who eat alone?
So, you know, that's an interesting thing. So ironically, even though I have a partner, we have very different schedules. So I often eat alone. And even though I'm not as good at this as I would like to be, my clients over the years have taught me a lot. And so what one did, which I thought was really beautiful, is she went and bought a fun place setting, like from Target or Pier One. So the placemat, the plate, had a candle or a flower in front of her, had the silverware and the napkin, and just allowed herself to eat as if it was a celebration. And then just really tasting each bite and noticing how it felt in her mouth and in her body and really preparing that food. I think the eating part alone isn't as challenging as the cooking part. And that could be a whole nother podcast on how to cook for one person, because I think that's a part.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Did that answer your question?
It does. Thank you. And that's such an interesting area. I feel like that could be a podcast in itself as well.
Well, it could. Because, you know, our innate thing, especially in a restaurant, at least for me, if I was alone, would be to read or do something else. And then it takes us away from truly connecting to what the food is doing in our body. At the same time, that's not the worst thing if it's a pleasurable book, you know, versus like reading the news.
Right.
And you can always put music on in the background or eat outside when it's nice and just listen to the sounds around you.
Mm-hmm. And that's, yesterday I was up in the cities and I rarely am by myself, and I ended up having lunch by myself. And the first instinct was to sit there and answer emails and be on my phone. And then it's like, oh my gosh, wait, I'm all by myself for a meal. Like, I have to appreciate this. So
you can jump up and down. Yeah. Joy.
I can eat as fast or slow as I want. So
exactly. Isn't that nice?
It was nice to sit outside and like actually appreciate eating a meal. So
I think it's interesting because I grew up in the 70s, and so we had meal times. I mean, both of my parents weren't working for part of my life, and then my mom had a part-time job, but you know, you didn't have cell phones. We didn't even have computers. So a mealtime was uninterrupted, and nobody would call you at that time or stop by because they knew the families were eating. So it's a very different world now.
Yeah, that's very true. And I mean, I remember that as well. Like, yeah, we just had a time when dad got home from work for us, you know, my dad got home from work and then we had dinner like every night, same time.
And so I guess, you know, kind of pulling in the novelty with meals is, even if you're by yourself or with people, how do you make that experience novel? So really appreciating the food as if it's, you've never had it before, even if it's the same thing you have every Tuesday.
That's a really good point.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right. Well, let's get back to the 5-3-2. So let's hear.
Oh, you're good. Nicely done. So the two is very simple. It's the first 20 people you see, and I say plants and animals because my day always starts out walking my dog on the bluff, so I don't see people right away, is just to extend a silent I wish you well. And again, the idea of all these techniques is not only to help the brain decrease the cortisol levels, but create new neural pathways that can focus on kindness and compassion. And so extending I wish you well not only creates compassion for the person you're extending it to, but also for yourself. And, you know, there's research that shows that, you know, if we focus on compassion, that creates happiness, more so maybe than even focusing on happiness to create compassion, if that makes sense. So a fun story that I tell people with the I wish you well is, two things. I had my staff do it. So we worked at an old hospital and people would come off the elevator and they'd be the first people that the clients would see. And so they would say, I wish you well in their mind. And they noticed that they felt better about their work. They were happier and they saw a shift in the clients. They didn't look as anxious and stressed during that time that they did it. And then another time I had been in my first car accident and I didn't understand the process. And I was calling about my check that I was hoping was coming and it hadn't come yet because my car had been totaled. And so the woman was a little, I wouldn't say rude, but she was a little abrupt and I was in a hurry. And immediately my mind wanted to go to that place like where you kind of get in a conflict or, you know, kind of say, well, why can't you get this done? Or, you know, not a very nice kind way to approach her. And I didn't do that. She had me on hold. And while she was on hold, I remembered her name. And so I said her name. And then I just said, I wish you well. I wish you well. And when she came back, she said, Ms. Stinson, your check is in the mail. You should get it by the end of the week. And I don't know that that changed it, but it was nice because it helped me calm down. I was much more civil and polite and respectful because it wasn't her fault. She was just doing her job. So when we get in those times of stress, when we have more demands on us than resources, such as time, we can tend to go to that place where we're not as civil and respectful and kind as we would want to be. So those are my two examples of I wish you well that worked really well.
I feel like all three of these things, I'm like, I'm going to start doing this now. Yeah, and you're so easy. That's the nice part. It just, you just have to remember to do them.
Yep. And I think what Dr. Sood says, and he's got so many books out there, and in one of them, it's called, I think, Mindfulness for the 21st Century, is that, you know, our minds are just so busy and they're so occupied. We have like 150 undone tasks at one time that these are techniques and strategies that can give you success right away so you don't feel like a failure and they don't take a lot of time. So you can do them anywhere.
Yeah, that is so cool and so important. Like you said, with a million things in your mind, sometimes the last thing you want to do is add another thing to your list. But I think this is very doable. And it also creates that good feeling, like, you know, feeling the happiness. And I love that you said compassion creates happiness, but more than happiness creates compassion. And could you dive into that a little bit too?
So before I was going to do this podcast, I randomly opened up his book, The Mayo Clinic Guide to Stress-Free Living, and it happened to be Compassion is Hardwired. And on there was the quote, the pursuit of compassion can make us happier than the pursuit of happiness.
Wow.
So, you know, let me just give a little brain science because I think it helps to explain the compassion piece. So, you know, our brain is hardwired for something called negativity bias. And it's important for us to know that so that we are more compassionate to ourselves when our brain goes in directions we might not want it to. The reason it was designed that way was for safety and protection. So, you know, in the primitive days, the things that were threats to us were like tribes and bears and wild animals and, you know, things like that. And so the brain wanted to respond to protect us. Now we don't have those same threats, but our brain sometimes still responds the same way. So we often focus on the things that we find negative. So like if you read your podcast reviews and you had 20 reviews that were all amazing and wonderful, which I know they are, and you had one that was questionable or negative, we tend to focus on that one negative instead of looking at the 20. And again, that's the way our brains naturally go. So when we start doing these techniques, we can create that other pathway that allows us to say, you know what? I read that. It's okay. That person can have their opinion and maybe there's truth to that. Maybe there isn't. And I can still feel good and compassionate about myself and that person. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I think if we can understand the negativity bias, it allows us to understand why we generally go that way. And so with compassion, what he talks about is that we have mirror neurons so that they, when you see people being compassionate, then your brain registers that same emotion and allows you, if you create that action, to have the same response in the brain. So like when you watch a movie and you feel sad or you feel whatever you see happening in that movie, like I'm trying to think of something recently. Well, so I watched Endgame, the Avengers movie, and I cried more than I ever thought I would cry. And it was beautiful because you saw these characters going back in time and connecting to relationships that they might not have had resolution to or had sad feelings or negative feelings for, and then they were able to see it in a different light and come to peace and closure with them. And so our brain felt that same pain and experience as if it was happening to us. And so when you watch people being compassionate to each other, in a way, I guess I could simply say it's contagious. So we want to do that. And when we can teach our kids that, they found that kids and adults that show more compassion actually have better mental health than those that don't.
And how do you teach compassion?
You just model it. That's a great question, Amy.
Yeah.
You know, here's one thing that we do that's an exercise that I think is really easy is we so often focus on our differences. And like even in the world today, there's so many splits in so many different areas of the world that if we could just for a moment put ourselves in the other person's shoes and see what would life be like if I was in that person's shoes with their history, their experiences, their wiring of their brain. And so an exercise that you can do to help you get there is to, like, with your spouse or with a friend or when you're in a group, like I do this when I do presentations, is pair off and then find 2 to 3 things that you have in common beyond your gender, you know, you go a little deeper. And then we find that we can connect to each other so much better when we find those commonalities. So that's one way to build compassion.
That's wonderful. That's something as a parent, I think, like you said, being able to model that is so important. And then is there anything else you wanted to talk about as far as resilience goes before we wrap up today?
Oh, look at that. Look at the time. I just think if we can, since we're on the word compassion, if we can just have compassion for our innate being and how our brains were designed to function, and in doing that, have the knowledge and the strength to know that we can also work on changing that hardwiring and creating more neural pathways that allow us to be kind and joyful and compassionate. And the importance of that, just kind of like the mirror neurons, is what we focus on is what gets stronger connections in the brain. So if I focus on compassion, kindness, and joy, then my brain creates those pathways and neural pathways. When I focus on the negativity and the differences and the things I don't like, then my brain goes to that network. So we have the ability to change that, where before I don't think we all knew we could do that. So really just allowing ourselves to be compassionate towards ourselves and others, and knowing that if we do those 3 techniques that we can, you know, have significant improvement in our stress and our happiness.
I love that. And that's recently I heard Wayne Dyer, I was listening to his recordings, and he talked a lot about what you focus on grows. And that's kind of like the neurobiology behind that exact statement, you know, like what you focus on is kind of the hardwiring that you create. So
you got it. So you articulated it much clearer. That is exactly it.
Yeah, that is really important. And I think it's so meaningful to teach your children that as well. And like you said, to be able to model that and live it.
I think with just one thing, when you said that again with the children, is, you know, the idea of creating the kindness and compassion is really so our children can grow up in a different world than what we have right now. Mm-hmm. And I think the sooner we can teach them these strategies that I just taught you and your listeners, the sooner they can start developing those resiliency muscles. And my hope would be someday it would be something we would actually teach in the schools. So they would have the tools to handle the chaos. Yep.
Yeah, I hear pieces and parts of this in certain schools, and you hear like the wonderful stories, but to have it like in all schools and, you know, just mainstream would be so amazing.
Yeah.
All right. So what does the word nourish mean to you?
So nourish means to me right now, I'm thinking of water as nourishing because I'm thirsty. So, nourishing to me is anything that brings joy and healing and love to my body, mind, and spirit. So the things that nourish me are being in nature, having loving and kind connections with people and joyful connections with people. So getting out and having fun. And actually doing something of service is nourishing to me.
I love that. That's beautiful. And I think, you know, being around you and knowing you as a friend too, you're just full of everything that you talk about and the inner beauty and, you know, just, it's just nourishing to even be with you. So anyway.
Well, thank you, Amy. I would say the same thing back to you. And I do have a plug to put in. I grew up with some pretty amazing parents and I they're in heaven now, but I do have gratitude for them because they did model everything that I talk about.
Oh, that's beautiful. How wonderful.
Yeah.
So, well, thank you, Sarah, for joining me today. And I can't wait to talk to you for part two. And if our listeners have questions or want to connect with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
So I think the easiest way would be to email me, and that would be Stinson, S-T-I-N-S-O-N dot Sarah, S-A-R-A-H, at Mayo, M-A-Y-O, dot E-D-U.
Thank you so much for listening to Nourish and Shine. I hope that you enjoy this episode and that you'll leave me a review on iTunes so that more people can hear the podcast. I'd also love to connect with you on social media. You can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. I would love to hear your questions, so please send them my way. Also, you can check out my website. It's amysopola.com. I hope that today's interview provided you with some inspiration and practical advice to nourish your mind, body, and spirit, optimize your health, and to live a whole, vibrant life. Please join me again next week for another amazing interview. Have a wonderful week. The information provided on this podcast is for educational purposes only. It's not intended to diagnose or treat any disease or condition. Please do not apply any of this information without first speaking with your medical provider.